Coming up, it's Media Matters with Marie Buskey and Marty Gibson, discussing the media through the RCR lens,
right here on Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Reality Check Radio here with Marie. Time for the M&M, your favourite time of the week. I know it is. Media Matters with Marie and Marty. I'm just riffing off the Trump. This is your favourite time of the week. I know it is.
We got the best people.
Marty Gibson, welcome back. How are you?
Hey, thanks. Oh, I'm awesome. Yep, good.
Yeah, good. Quick shock check.
Yeah, no, it's we've got to eat a few more eggs. But, yeah, I've sort of seen signs of the Hunterway and Diggins, sort of got the message that chickens aren't allowed in my garden. So she's kind of starting to chase back over the fence. I've got to adjust a fence. It's a bit low. So now and then one of them flies the coop.
Good on, Diggins. Well done. Mm. Right. Well, you and I have both covered a bit of ground since we spoke last. And the theme hit me smack between the eyes, which covers a great number of stories that I've read across the weekend and the last few days. I've not preempted you like I usually do. So this is my theme or question. Are we embarking on a new class war?
Well, I think it's underway.
Yeah.
And I've talked about this on a number of occasions because it's an idea that's been steadily building in my head. It's the war between people who notice things and the people who just want to be told what to do. And the reason we're at war is because fat controllers have set us against each other. If you look at a village, you know, if you think about it in terms of human evolution, in terms of society, if you think about a village largely self-reliant, you know, it has to scrape for survival because it's before fossil fuels. You only need a few people wasting energy worrying about things. You just want the rest to be digging, planting, sowing, doing all the other stuff. And so we've sort of got to see through COVID who the noticers are and who the dumbfounded dipshits are. And the noticers, because we kind of, you know, it's only recently revealed, we thought we call them the DDs or the diggers. We thought they were just not coming around because of a lack of information. They're not coming around because there's some people who just like being told what to do. And the fat controllers, the aspirin neo-feudalists, set us against each other and told the dumbfounded dipshits that we were crazy, that we meant them harm, that we were selfish, that we wanted to kill their grandmother, that we were dangerous, maybe even evil. And so a strategy going forward has to be to reclaim our position.
And also, too, that strategy was... And that strategy was rolled out again by all of those who were trying to get the Democrats elected, Kamala Harris elected in the United States, and it did not come off. We've covered that extensively here, how it didn't come off. I've got a number of pieces that I want to cover. The first thing I'm going to cover is close to home, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. I spoke to David Seymour, which aired this morning, around it, which, of course... Yes, I did. Is all this brouhaha, I haven't used that word for ages, all this brouhaha around the hikoi, which I have to admit, I thought, because, you know, hikoi means walking, I thought that they were doing a whole whenua kupa. Now, I like the term on X, the car koi, that's what it is. It's essentially a proxy by Te Pāti Māori organised by Rāwiri's wife and John Tamahere's daughter and a few others to pull together a protest. And I'm wondering, based on what you've said, is how many people now, how many dumbfounded dipshits are going to transition, how many DDs are going to transition to notices after what has actually transpired in the wider world over the last several weeks and actually see this hikoi for what I think is the great virtue signal and distraction, which is what it actually is.
All waha no kaha.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, you can look and think, well, one of my favourite notices in this sphere is Dr. Muriel Newman. She writes like a diamond on glass about it. And I revisited her column from the end of October. So, you know, it's going back a couple of weeks, but it's very relevant in light of the hikoi. And she opened that by quoting David Longhi, who said back in November 2000, democratic government can accommodate Maori political aspiration in many ways. What it cannot do is acknowledge the existence of a separate sovereignty. As soon as it does that, it isn't a democracy. We can have a democratic form of government or we can have indigenous sovereignty. They can't coexist and we can't have both. Now, the media can't air those views because they signed up to the Public Interest Journalism Fund, which stipulated that they had to only frame the treaty as a partnership, and they had to acknowledge that New Zealand was a racist country that had systemically disadvantaged Māori. So, again, the fat controllers have turned off the notices and set them against the people who go along to get along. My equivalent to your brouhaha is zoom out. Who wants to erode our national government? You know, the globalists do. So, you know, I'd say to Māori, you know, women, you know, I've said this before as well, women thought the CIA and the Rockefellers were doing them a big favor and uplifting them by sponsoring feminism back in the 60s and 70s. But what they were sponsoring was division and demoralization of the most likely opponents. Māori should think on that.
Yeah, and I also, too, the thing that frustrated the absolute bejesus out of me, there are times where I just feel like saying to Christopher Luxon, stop talking, just stop talking, say nothing. You're better off saying nothing than what you said this week in terms of, you know, making it quite clear, you know, over-egging the pudding that he's not going to be supporting this. I don't know about you, I noticed a lot of I and royal we in this.
Well,
I mean, is he speaking for himself or is he speaking for all national supporters and their constituents? I wasn't quite sure. I think more the former than the latter.
Well, my indifference and contempt toward Luxon is slowly turning to anger. I'm finding, you know, the David Brent of New Zealand politics is the meat in the path of the tiger at the moment. And the election of Trump should send a clear message to national. Mm. And that's that his brand of bland, vacuous, amoral, globalist wishy-washiness is out and the opposite is in. He's got to go and join his fellow travellers in the WEF or the Gates Foundation. It reminds me, you know, when I'm listening to him talk, I mean, he does remind me of David Brent out of The Office, but he also reminds me of Patrick Bateman off American Psycho, where he does that soliloquy where he says, there is an idea of a Patrick Bateman, some kind of abstraction, but there is no real me, only an entity, something illusory. And though I can hide my cold gaze and you can shake my hand and feel flesh gripping yours, and maybe you can even sense our lifestyles are probably comparable, I simply am not there.
Mm.
It's, yeah. And, you know, the rates of, I'm not saying Luxon's a psycho, but he is one of those people who works really well in the corporate arena because he doesn't have a strong personality and he wants to be a good boy. That's his main driving thing. Oh, so if I say this, am I a good boy? Oh, mm. Good boys not say that and not believe in that. Oh, I don't believe in that. I want to be a good boy. Oh, you know, well, I work for Unilever and so I can just put that mask on and I'm Unilever, the Prime Minister of New Zealand.
Mm. Yeah, I took a swipe at him in Kiwi Farm this week too, just in terms of that. I called him a palm tree in the face of political and public opinion, and he is now actually, I think, if he does not shore up the trunk, he is going to fall foul of what the political winds, and I, in Kiwi Farm, I referred it to the hurricane rump. There is going to be a change in terms of how people feel, that unspoken permission, that in culture and in discourse, which I think will begin to happen. Because all of us black sheep and crazy chickens and people that live in the independent media space who have been disparaged and, as you mentioned before, right at the very beginning, treated like second-class citizens.
Well, framed as being stupid, evil, gullible.
Yeah. All of a sudden, it's like, yeah, perhaps not. So I'm done with the hikoi. I'm just well and truly over it. But I do want to transition now on that point to Bruce Cottrell, because I don't know why I do this to myself every week. I start reading everything else and then I like save Cottrell, like for that last big chunk of chocolate that you have when you're a kid and you want to save the best bit for last.
Probably that you're worried that if you read him first, your ideas, you know, you think you've got them off him, because yeah, often I'm not so much about the sport, but certainly in his column this week, I was very much I thought it was a brilliant column, and I was surprised that it made the paper.
Well, thank you very much. Me too. So Bruce Cottrell, opinion piece, obviously Saturday Weekend Herald. The headline is How Working Class Reshaped US Politics. Now, I came up with my little class question, had it all written down before I'd even gotten to this piece, got here and thought, oh, crikey, this just puts absolutely the exclamation mark on where my thinking was at. He has taken a look at the win with Donald Trump, and I think probably his analysis, I think, has been the clearest and most concise. So he hasn't sort of pushed too much one way or another, but he's looked at it very, very clearly. And this is where this unwritten permission comes in. And this is something that I'm watching out for. I think we're going to see more of it. We saw it straight after COVID, once the rules changed. You know, as I mentioned the other day, you know, the minute you went from people who are mask Nazis one minute to everyone running around without a mask on like nothing had happened, and your memory hole, you know, what had gone before. He is saying here, while it's a bad day for the Democrats, it's also a massive punch in the nose for those campaigning the world's causes. At the top of that list is the United Nations, but they're joined by the climate activists, the champions for NATO and the World Economic Forum. It's a kick in the guts for Hollywood and a celebrity culture that sought to influence politics. And let's not forget the broadcast television networks and the US and around the world who championed the Democratic campaign and lost. These are the TV networks that wanted us to accept their views on the Middle East, Ukraine, and the economy. They want to convince us of their views on climate and vaccinations, but their platform for doing so is in tatters.
Mm.
I don't think he would have said something quite strongly worded prior to the election, do you?
Yeah, well, it's being framed as people have got suddenly permission to be misogynist and racist. I think it's worse than that for mainstream media. They've got permission to say the emperor's wearing no clothes, and you know, his acknowledgement that alternative medias and podcasters who have carried the day is very interesting as well. I mean, especially printed in the Herald. I was talking with Glenn Inwood this morning, who's looking forward to having on the Fourth Estate this week. And he jokingly suggested that we rename the show Media Doesn't Matter. As I've often lamented, I'm finding that consuming New Zealand's mausoleum media, which is a term coined by UK politician George Galloway, is increasingly like trying to eat reheated fish and chips after I've feasted on the sumptuous buffet that is the alternative media. Late and Smith. And, of course, a generous helping of Reality Check Radio.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
A feeling I increasingly get as I read or watch their vapid, vacuous simperings is that they're the accomplice that's trying to distract me with triviality while the aspirant neo-feudalists pick my pockets, steal my country.
Yeah. Yep, Simon Wilson, you said to me, did you read the Simon Wilson? I went, I started, but I got so bilious.
Simon,
I had to stop.
Bloody Wilson.
Anyway, let's stay with Cottrell because, you know, I've had enough dyspepsia for the day. Anywho, while the traditional media have to count the election results as one of the worst days, the new media won and won big. Individuals rather than networks carry the election with their coverage and their backing of the successful candidate. People broadcasting one-person shows like Megyn Kelly, Tucker Carlson, Joe Rogan and others and proved that media is no longer changing. It has changed. Elon Musk's X, formerly Twitter, provides a platform for non-network news operators to access the masses. And while there are plenty of people who haven't found these channels yet, you can bet that this election outcome will change that too. I heard one commentator calling the election results the revenge of the working class American. Let's not forget that Trump and his supporters were called garbage by the outgoing president and were likened to Nazis by left-leaning media. And the DDs, I think, are waking up all the time, and they are looking for alternatives. Even in this country, you know, I'm chatting to people nearly every day. I'm talking to different people who are catching up and wanting to see what I'm up to, and even ones who went a little silent on us during COVID because of our stance are sort of starting to re-engage, and they're aware of...
Yeah, you're the village noticer.
Yeah.
You're starting to realise that the Pied Piper was actually malevolent. We've got to form a strategy around that. It's a tough thing to do. I mean, I know you love a good animal farm, kiwi farm analysis, but if you're working sheep, there is that moment when one sheep makes a break for it through a gate that's maybe opened or something like that. And once all the sheep start running,
yeah, you can't stop
it's really
them.
Hard to round them up.
Well, and you know what? And using that analogy, what's happened up until
now? Oh, I knew you'd jump at that.
Oh, I know. Being a good farm girl, I couldn't help myself. But that's the thing. You know, what's happened now is up until this point with cancellation and cancel culture is that one sheep will go and it gets mauled. Yeah. Absolutely mauled and worried.
The other sheep go, ooh, what a whoop.
Exactly. That power is now disappearing. I was in the day job. I was chatting to someone who's over from Australia, a client. I haven't seen them in person for some time. They've got a business, a very, very long established business in Australia, and we were talking about the culture war stuff. And he said, how's it all going on that front? I mean, you just keep trucking on and you've been waging that war for such a long time. And I said, well, this is the thing. I've been cancelled and I'm still going. I don't care. I don't engage. I don't, certainly don't apologise. I don't look at anything that is going on in that space. I just keep focused on what it is that we're doing and try to do it to the best of our abilities. And that's the secret. Once you've been cancelled, as Rene Gulich, one of my guests once said, that's your ticket out of the matrix. Yeah. And I think more and more people have suddenly realised that cancellation is no longer the threat that it used to be. And Bruce Cottrell has proved it. The fact that he even said they wanted to convince us of their views on climate and vaccination, but their platform for doing so is in tatters. He could not say that even 6 months ago without being.
Yeah, the thing that, because you've seen a few shrill headlines, disinformation won the election. He writes this. Freedom of speech is being challenged somewhere around the world daily. In Australia this week, we're seeing the government attempting to introduce a misinformation bill. We're seeing governments having a crack at individuals because of something on social media. But as we've learned, the disinformation is seldom coming from we the people. I mean, that's incredible that he's written that. On the COVID pandemic, we know that much of the disinformation is peddled by governments. And as we consider the recent outcomes of the US election, we also know that the major TV networks are as guilty of misinformation as anyone. Wow.
I know, that got a lot of highlighted from me. I actually read that out to Mr. Murray, and he looked at me and he went, is that in the Herald? And I went, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They look to the media to start doing that Simpsons thing where Kent Brockman thinks they're being subject to an alien invasion, says, I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords. Mm. They're going to start being all friendly.
Mm. And he rounds it off with, and so as times get tougher and the result of those overlapping crises, the people understandably are pushing back. Centre-right parties across Europe have led the way in most of the year's electoral contests. In South America, El Salvador's new president has taken an extreme response to their crime wave, and Argentina's new president is one of the most aggressive in pursuing economic reform. The new Dutch government is pushing back on immigration and others are following. The people, newly motivated by souring economics, a depressing outlook and the threat of outside controls impacting their lives, are pushing back. The people, the working class, are saying, we've had enough. And that's what we saw in America this week. And we shouldn't be surprised. And it's more than that. Look what's happening in Germany. That coalition is disintegrating. And Christine Anderson's the MEP party will probably, there potentially could be more influence there. And then with the announcement that Donald Trump made around freedom of speech. And this is where this is so important. And he sort of ostensibly put out a warning shot across the bow to any of the allies who are looking to censor and stifle freedom of speech, looking at you, Australia, looking at you, United Kingdom, looking at you, Scotland. Mm. You know, they should be concerned. And that, I think, for me, is hopeful. It will potentially get those in line. The Canadians, Pierre Poilievre, I mean, what did Ramesh say the other night on the Foundation members' call? He's currently sitting at a 25-point lead for their elections in less than a year now in Canada. This, I think this is a signalling of a correction to this absolute seismic shift of the Overton window left. Will it correct completely? No. But will we start seeing some sanity return? I really do hope so, because I am so over it.
Yeah, well, something else we've got to see, and I mean, if, and you know, if politicians have an ounce of sense, they'll think about this, is that observation that I quoted Eric Weinstein is making, that the problem with capitalism and the reason people keep going back to communism, even though it's just by every measure failed and is terrible, is that capitalism hasn't provided a sufficient consolation to the losers. And so, and it always surprised me the way right-leaning or politicians allow the left to run away with that, oh, we really care thing, when they should say, hey, look, we care too. We're just into more long-term kindness rather than short-term sugar hit kindness. You know, giving meth addicts meth kind of kindness rather than, you know, arresting them and giving them treatment.
Mm, mm. You wouldn't have had a chance to watch this because I only flicked it to you last night. We watched a 1 hour long interview. Peter Robinson from the Hoover Institute has he does a podcast. He does
a bit of it. I mean, I love that guy.
He's great. Yeah, he's great. And he had with him Andrew Roberts, I think he's Lord Melrose, Neil Ferguson, who I just love, and Victor Davis Hanson, who is probably one of the greatest historians in the United States. And their conversation, and it was so well structured, their conversation, just looking at where we are currently, different quotations from different things, different historians and commentators, but also too looking at that interview with Tucker Carlson and the populist historian that he had on around his comments on Churchill, and just sort of dissecting all of that, and then the overlay of this applied history that Ferguson is now looking at, and essentially it, in absolute layman's terms, is how you can take the learnings of history and apply that to things today and essentially not have history repeating itself. And what are the commonalities? What are the things that do not change all the way through? And Hanson covered that brilliantly towards the end. And it was actually quite hopeful. And to sit down and to listen to a conversation like that, those are the conversations I think people are starving for. Those are the things that people are wanting. And one of the biggest things that came out of that is they were talking about the degradation within the academic sphere, which I know is things that Eric Weinstein has talked about, and his brother Brett, Pete Pitgosian, and that over-specialisation, the over-specialisation that you have in academia where you become essentially so up your, the inside of your own anus that you're only talking to other people that reside also on the insides of their own anus, and you completely lose touch with everyday people. Whereas
disorientating place to live in it. And you can, it's amazing how the stuff they write has all these airy assertions. It's, well, of course, the British invented racism back in the 1800s. So just as we invented it, we can uninvent it. And you're looking for numbers, you're looking for references. They're just not there. It's such flimsy scholarship.
Mm.
It's coming to an end. I mean, the Trump's talking about an academic system that allows Americans to get qualified outside of the normal university system and with a lot less debt is, I mean, that's very interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And I'm glad you brought that up, because that's going to transition to me to the piece. Did you read the one that was in, I think it was the Sunday Star Times? Actually, there was two articles, one in the Sunday Star Times and a second one, our mate, Liam Dan, around youth employment. And there's also been a survey that's been floating around in the ether as well about Gen Zers and millennials in the workplace.
I read the Liam Dan one. You don't have to go back too far where we're saying, oh, we need to have more unemployment rate because monetary theory.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And you didn't really analyze. You sort of said, oh, you know, they jacked up the minimum wage and it meant that, you know, a young person could go out and get a job. Spoken truly like someone who's never employed anyone.
No, exactly. Exactly. And so one of the things that came in around just, and this is broad brush strokes, was the youth unemployment. I mean, let's face it, unemployment, particularly for the youth, is always going to be the first to go when you've got pressure on a job market. So we had a lot of youth entering into the job market, and that's what Dan was saying. He said, oh, it was wonderful because they now, the youth wage was gone. They got, were getting minimum wage. They were being paid well. They entered into the workforce because there were no other options. But now we've got migrants back. And of course, employers are employing a migrant worker who's a new migrant to New Zealand because, oh, I don't know, they probably turn up on time and don't whinge and complain and work their absolute tripes out and, you know, get the job done as opposed to, you know, from these young Kiwis. Then, but he's saying, but the good news is they're staying in education longer. Oh, yeah, racking up all that student debt. That's really, really good for them moving forward and becoming, what, more specialised in a certain area and actually even becoming more unemployable?
Yeah, I mean, it, again, you know, you could look at that short-term kindness versus long-term kindness. For a young person who's just starting out in employment, the short-term kindness is, oh, jack up the minimum wage and equity. You know, he's living at home, really, you know, they can get by unless the long-term kind thing is to abolish the minimum wage for them. So they get a job, they just get paid what someone will pay them. But if you've got someone working for you, a young person who's getting paid $10 an hour rather than 25, you can just have them follow along and watch what you're doing. You can take the time to teach them things that are going to make them worth far more than the minimum wage. If you've got to pay a kid $25, all you can do is just give them the most boring, repetitive work possible, because otherwise you can't make money out of what they do because they're kids.
Mm, exactly. You wouldn't have heard the interview that I did yesterday with Michael Kingston, and he is the former superintendent. He's a general physician and former superintendent of Gisborne Hospital, and actually is now currently residing in Gisborne. And anywho, he was talking about in terms of junior doctors and how too much over-reliance is placed on these junior doctors, and they've not given the training and the mentoring that they require, and also the broadening of skills. So they've become, again, this over-specialisation, and that is certainly happening within medicine. And we're seeing it everywhere. You know, it's that old TSB ad, you know, oh, I only do streets and avenues. I don't do lanes and crescents or whatever it is. You know, people are becoming way too compartmentalised. In the Sunday Star Times article, there was a girl here from the Student Job Search, Louise Savica. And she says here, she talks about, Savica thinks some students will instead keep studying so they can still access their student loans. Again, quite dangerous. That squares with what Otago University Student Association President Keegan Wells hears from friends and uni leavers. It's incredibly difficult for students to obtain jobs in their field. And then what is the solution? Sherry Perro has worked in education for 33 years and has careers counselling for 10. The change with this generation of kids, she believes, is they want their job to have purpose. Now, I don't know about you, but when I've had plenty of jobs that don't have a tremendous amount of purpose, they were just a job to, you know, get from point A to point B. I mean, as parents, is this something that we're not preparing our children for? Are we giving them a false sense of security and an illusion that for those ones that do go off to university, whether or not university is the best place for them or not, that when they come out, they should expect to have a job that is elevated to the status that they've built in their own mind, and we haven't actually taught them that, you know what, you're going to start at the bottom, you've got to roll your sleeves up, and there'll be things that you have to do that you may not necessarily like of a day, but you just got to suck it up, buttercup, and do it.
Well, I mean, I maybe think of it in more motivational terms, and, you know, say it's part of the training. You know, if you can't, you know, a lot of young people might get a ball bag job and think, oh, I'm too good for this. Oh, what's the point? The point is, if you can't even do a ball bag job well, what makes you think you're going to do your dream job well? You know, use it to get those basic disciplines. And when I was cleaning contracting, you know, I had a lot of people working for me who were engineers or people who were traveling and, you know, would be thinking that, oh, how far I've fallen. You know, one of the things I used to do was say, well, you know, think about what you want to do in life and tell me about, you know, what do you want to do? And they'd tell me, and I said, well, this is how that's going to help you. You're going to learn how to finish something properly. You're going to learn how to allocate your time efficiently. Use it as training. You know, it'll get you fit. Move your hands faster. That's the best way to speed up productivity. When you're going to do something, make sure you've got the requisite gear. Do it as well as you can. And when you get tired of it, do something else, but don't half-ass it.
One of the jobs I had a lot when I was much younger, and actually our oldest son is doing the same job, was dishwashing in kitchens.
Oh, what a great bit of training that is.
Yeah, well, it is, because you are working, it teaches you teamwork. You're actually, even though you're the dish pig, you are actually a surprisingly important part of the entire machinery of a kitchen. If you're not doing your job effectively and efficiently, you know, you're bringing the whole team down. So you've got that. You learn about hierarchy. You learn about pressure. There's so many things that you learn dishwashing.
Yeah. No, it's awesome. I mean, yeah, and there's always that thing, and it's often by people who've never, you know, worked that. Oh, you know, when you start out, you're sweeping the floors like it's the worst thing. You know, sweep the floors. I had to take pride in having a floor that's absolutely immaculate. You know, like, I mean, I've had plenty of jobs where, yeah, I've worked for some pretty unhinged people. What the hell are you doing stepping over that bit of rubbish? Jesus Christ. You know, what goes on in your head? Like, if you see something like that, it should just stick out to you. You should pick it up. Blah, blah, blah. That was before you could sue people for talking to you like that.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how things move forward in the youth space. The difficulty, like, I mean, our second son is trying to find a holiday job at the moment. He's struggling. He's really, he's putting CVs out there. He's, you know, beating the shoe leather to try and find something. They, you know, they certainly aren't hiring. And that's the sad part. I am a really firm believer of getting these kids into some form of employment, because it just teaches them life skills that they move forward. And on the, I did hear via Talkback on another station, they were talking about this job survey, and I can't even remember who brought it out. And one of the callers was saying that as an employer, and they were a reasonably large employer, that the thing that they were tackling with graduates coming through is unlike the day probably when you're a graduate. And see, I was never a graduate. I literally went straight from I just went straight into the university of life. That they have never, he said, they've got graduates now coming out at 22, 23, 24 years old, depending on the size of their degree, who have literally never worked in paid employment ever.
Wow. So my first paid job, and I was, I think, well, the first, you know, formal go-to-work paid job, and I was 12.
Yeah, I was 13.
My grandfather really took it upon himself to teach me to work, and it is a skill. The skill is constantly reminding yourself to go faster. And we were talking when I was telling you my psychotic desire to take to my printer with a baseball bat because it decided to stop doing its job this morning. You know, work is barely contained aggression, you know, physical work anyway. And there's been so much, I guess, stigmatizing of male aggression that we've maybe lost sight of what a vital part of getting things done fast it is.
Where would you like to go next? I've got a couple of things here, but I know you've done some really interesting prep. What else caught your eye across the week?
You know, I sort of, as I said, I chewed through a few things. Opinion by David Nassar, Trump and Musk, the bromance that cannot last, just quickly characterizing respectful relationships between men as romantic or semi-sexualized, I think is part of the move to depower men. And I think that's what a lot of the agenda to, you know, push normalization of homosexuality does. It's not to get men having sex with each other. It's to pollute fraternal love. That's what I thought about that. He was saying, yeah, the bromance between Trump and Musk cannot last. Abuse and care apology. There was a beautiful article from Sam Chapman, who's a man I admire tremendously. He's the co-founder of the AFI Community Development in Ōtara. He and his wife, Thelma, have helped rehabilitate dozens of Mongrel Mob members. He was received 2010 recipient of Kiwi Bank's New Zealand of the Year. So how far they fell after that.
Just before we dive off that, what were your thoughts around the apology the other day?
Well, I think it has been an incredibly long time coming. I've spoken to a lot of gang members who started their journey. They weren't necessarily bad people, but just had a terrible time by being taken into state care and never recovered from it. They had a record that just dogged them, and so they couldn't get ahead. And then they found, this is what Sam says, that's where the gangs thrive, because they offer acceptance, even if it's pathological. I mean, my interest in the things that are between the lines are, you know, you look at the Jimmy Savile thing, and just the way the establishment is not shy to use blackmail as a method of keeping people in line. I wonder if that, you know, this is in the dark part of my wonderings. And many of the people said that, you know, they were abused by people who appeared to be well-dressed. You know, to what extent has there been a reluctance by the establishment to confront the awful things that happened to these children because they were used as a tool to keep people in line in an incidental but tragic way?
Well, it just shows you the corruption of power of when you have one individual that holds so much power over another. The apology, I know, will mean a lot, particularly for those really historic victims. Some of them, I think 1950 was some of the earliest offences.
The thing that
makes me so frustrated is that, having spoken to Melissa Davies, second part was released yesterday, 23 years she has been fighting with this organisation. There are key people within Oranga Tamariki or the state apparatus that have been actively thwarting and perpetrating abuse towards her and her family, and it's still going on. So to have that apology and the abuse is still happening, for me, I just find it's a bitter pill. It's like, you know, saying, being an arsonist, that saying sorry for setting a fire as you're lighting a match to your next target.
Yeah, I think the step that we've got to take beyond the apology is to realise that the awful actions of those people and the terrible victimisation of the children in their care shouldn't put us off the aspiration of creating an environment that children can go to and be safe. And so we need to reimagine how we do that, whether we do it by having a standards of citizenship where people are understood to be upright citizens. I mean, we have that in the school. You know, you've got to pass a police vetting test to help with school trips and so on. And, yeah, have a high standard of people who can volunteer maybe to work in those environments for a week just to keep the sunlight in there.
Well, I think it's a case too that it just shows that if you have an over-reliance on the state to fix something, they're not going to fix it. They can actually make it worse. And I think this is what this apology goes some way towards, is an acknowledgement that, they didn't do a great job, but they're still not doing a great job. And that's what I get frustrated about, is that, and it's not just them, it's not just all those mechanisms within those departments and those people, and it's everywhere. I mean, we're seeing it in health, we're seeing it with all aspects of social development. I have to admit, getting more and more like you as I get older, the less the government is involved in something. And I think we need, as communities, we need to reinvigorate and re-step back up and fill that void, as we once did decades ago, as our grandparents did, as our parents did. Our generation, I think, partially has lost that skill because we've been taught to abrogate it to the state, believing that they will do it. And that chain of trust is now broken. And we now actually need to take our own personal sovereignty back and actually get shit done ourselves.
Well, I have a very Eastern view on many things, actually, where I don't see the problem as one of good versus evil. I see it as imbalance. And while government is useful in many ways, it operates using a system of the process determines the outcome. And that's where so many things go wrong, because it's kind of a fire and forget thing. They may review it, but you can just keep having all of these dunderheaded mistakes and these bureaucrats who just keep enforcing absurdity. And what's needed to counter that or balance it is an outcome focus. So if something's not working, it's stopped rather than just chugging on like an out-of-control tractor.
Yeah, very much so. What else did you have on your list, my friend?
Yeah, again, Richard Preble wrote a good column on Trump. He was basically, you know, saying we've got all the same problems and we probably need some of the solutions. Here, those who created inflation are still in charge of monetary policy. The Biden administration lost control of the border. Our surge in immigration is a reason our housing, schools, and hospitals are overwhelmed. Parties that are led by failures are punished by the electorate. Which takes me back to my earlier point about Christopher Luxon. And I should say as well, you know, when he was asked, you know, what do you like about this bill?
Nothing.
Mm.
What do you hate about? Everything. I'm a good boy. Good boys think that.
Mm.
And yeah, I mean, he was coming right out and talking about the senselessness of the conflict in Ukraine as well. It's estimated there have been 1 million casualties. Around $816 billion will be needed for Ukraine's recovery. The war has cost Russia over $354 billion. It has increased world food prices and decreased world trade. So, yeah, I saw Simon Dallow on One News saying, you know, he's only just been elected and already Trump is meddling in Ukraine. It's like, what are you talking about? And when people say, oh, we've got to stay the course in Ukraine, I feel like punching them in the face. 1 million dead people, you big, brave man with skinny arms and a little pot belly. And there's people, you know, getting dragged out of nightclubs into buses. It's just awful. I'm with Trump on that. I just want people to stop dying.
Yeah.
Paul Henry wrote a bit of a weird article saying Joe should pardon Trump. And Shane Tupou, you know, you said, yeah, he's writing his own articles again. He had a little bit of a,
He did. So we know Helen Clark this week, people. I'm sorry because Shane wrote his own. There were several things that I quite liked about it, but it's what unites us is deeper than what divides us. I was talking to a guy identified as a soft Republican. What we had in common was our children and our hope for a better world, even though we disagreed on how to achieve it. And you can actually, for Shane, he had this time in the United States. He spoke to a whole bunch of people. And I think he actually realized that the other side weren't KKK members, Nazis, massive misogynists, and everything else that the media on his side were painting. And then at the end, he said, on my second to last day here, wanting to get home as quickly as I can, I had a brief exchange with an African-American maintenance guy at our hotel. He asked me how I was, and I said, I'm depressed, to be honest. He replied, today's a new day. Let's get on with life. That's right. Let's get on with life.
It's something the New Zealand Labour Party needs to consider too.
Yeah, I reckon.
People don't want the status quo with minor technocratic changes. If the left doesn't offer real hope, think Obama, Tony Blair, and Jacinda Ardern. Oh, my God, Shane. You just don't. I think you get it. I don't think you get it. And then there was Simon Bloody Wilson.
Oh, you can go there. Okay, I'm just going to sit down.
Will Robert Kennedy Jr. really be put in charge of public health?
I hope so.
If he is, he says he'll ban vaccines and Donald Trump says he's okay with that. Presumably, this means they will shut down research funding as well. The Nobel Prize in Medicine last year went to two researchers whose work on mRNA enabled the unprecedented rapid development of COVID vaccines. Both work at the University of Pennsylvania. We would not have a functional world today if it wasn't for them. And this is the best bit. We've got 4 more years of an erratic, vengeful leader of the most powerful nation on earth by a long stretch who governs in the name of nothing but his own self-interest. And this time round, it's going to be different. For one thing, he triumphed, won the popular vote, the Electoral College, the Senate, and probably the House, and he already has the Supreme Court. He's king now. We should all go and study Henry VIII. A not dissimilar tyrant. Oh, my God.
Oh, my goodness. I know. How many times does RFK Jr. have to say that all he wants is for drug companies and vaccine manufacturers to have their products tested in the same way and go through the same regulatory processes as any other medicine or drug, which at the moment they don't. And they have full immunity. So that's all he's asking.
Oh, and they've got a record of incredible fraud and malfeasance. And we're expected to, you know, just trust them. And I've got to buy Naomi Wolf's...
Oh, the Pfizer papers.
Book, you know, all the excerpts I'm seeing of her talking about that are just horrific. And again, the damn wall's going to break on this. You know, that we've got to have a moment of, I, for one, welcome our new insect overlords from the mainstream media. I think they're getting there. I think they're starting to realize it's time to acknowledge some of the things they've been ignoring.
Very, very much so.
Matt Beebe had a great article where he was talking about the impotence, the almost total impotence of traditional media. And he was saying, you know, there's been people who are saying that Trump should regulate monopoly media. But he says any revision of the FCC regulations introduced by Bill Clinton that destroyed local media would be counterproductive because they're basically dead anyway. He talked about Jimmy Kimmel, you know, how he rolled his eyes and told a joke about how ridiculous it was that people voted against Kamala Harris, because she wouldn't go on Joe Rogan's podcast. But Joe Rogan's podcast is roughly 25 times bigger than the biggest cable audience in America. I think we should probably talk more and more about what's happening in those spheres as part of our discussion of media.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, I'm going to go to some feedback. And one of the bits in feedback actually was a story that I did have a look at because it did appear in the weekend papers. And I think we can touch on it was, and it's from Jackie. Hi there, Marie and Marty. I was wondering what you guys think about this, please. It's News Talk ZB article, but it also appeared, I think, in the Saturday Herald, around medical school intakes. There it is. No, it was in the Saturday Herald. Uni boosts Māori and Pacific Med enrolments. I mean, there's been affirmative action in the enrolments in medical school since well before we were born. Anywho, affirmative action programs in the University of Otago have significantly lifted Māori and Pacific and rural enrolments over the past 30 years, but have failed to increase student numbers from poorer backgrounds. So ostensibly what it is, Māori now make up 20% of enrolments at the university's medical school over the past 4 years, reaching parity with European and Asian enrolments for the first time. Here's the problem. Is that all these Māori students come from very wealthy families or well-to-do or top schools and not from the poorer areas. But there are a couple of other numbers that intrigued me. The other one is Māori representation in the workforce is still relatively low at 4.7% of all doctors. Well, if you've got 20% of them in enrolments, but only 4.7 of them actually wash out into the workforce, and I know that 20% is a peak, but for argument's sake, let's halve that to 10% and only half of that actually work out to work in the sector. To me, that's a really high attrition rate.
Easy come, easy go.
Yeah.
Like once you're in medical school, it's pretty hard to wash out, but the washout rate for quota doctors. Students in it is pretty
much high. Yeah, and my husband said that when he went through Auckland, but he said that was the same. He said all the ones that got in on the quota, he said it was not uncommon to actually see them wash out. This is the one that the comment I found really interesting. Women now made up nearly two-thirds of all enrolments in health professional programs, up slightly from 1994. I think that the gender balance in tertiary education is worth thinking very carefully about, said Crampton, because at what point do we have a society becoming concerned by a relative underrepresentation of young men in tertiary education? Now, again, that's another one of those quotes that I don't think could have been said that long ago.
No. And I mean, if you talk to someone who's trying to run general practice, the gender wage gap doesn't exist because of sexism. It exists because women sensibly, I think, having grown up with a GP who just worked stupid hours, you know, I basically in some ways, you know, didn't spend much time with him because of he was so preoccupied with working. They don't want to do the night call. They don't want to work weekends. They don't want to work in crappy little centres.
Yep.
They're not as conventionally ambitious, and they get to about 30, and normally they've married someone who's at least as upwardly mobile as them, and they want to have babies. So they leave, and they'll come back for a day or two here or there, but they don't want to do the real grunt work. And then they've got a hide to whine about the gender wage gap. And, yeah, the fact that feminists have been allowed to get away so long whining about all these little microaggressions and absolutely unconcerned that 50% more women than men go on to tertiary training. And now they're saying there's no good men to marry. Ah!
I know. So, Jackie, thank you very much for highlighting that. And, look, I think affirmative action of any kind based on race is just a road to nowhere. And
it's so unfair to the people who really deserve it.
Mm. Yeah. Where's meritocracy? I'm sorry. I do not care. I want to know that if I go to see any expert, somebody that needs to treat me, drive me, fly me anywhere, I want to know that I'm with somebody who's capable and the best person for the job. I really don't care what they look like. I don't care who they sleep with. I don't care who they worship. I really don't care. I just want to know how good at their job they are. That's all I care about. Shocker. Very old-fashioned, I know. Anyway, continuing on with some feedback from Dingo. Hey, Dingo. Great name, Dingo. Three News, this is in regards to the US election. Three News, in reaction to the US election last night, said it's between a woman of colour and a convicted felon. Goodbye, MSN. Oh, I think we can all agree with that. Here for us, Media Matters, from Grant, count me in on that climate group, Marty. There you go.
Yeah.
I will help have done a bit of research over the years. There you go. I'm with you, Marty, on removing dairy from the Paris Accords too. You two absolutely rock. I get a good laugh. Oh, thank you. That's from the text machine. I'm glad you get a good laugh. We have a good laugh doing it, so that's good. Trump's success was that he made the election about his team, his country, and not about himself. Interesting, yes. He actually toned back that it's all about me, and it was very much about the team, so I will agree with that. In Elon's interview with Joe Rogan, Elon stated that agricultural emissions did not increase global warming and climate change. Unleash our farmers so they can grow more value for all New Zealanders. Regards, Lloyd. You're getting a bit of traction there, Marty, for your idea.
I think it's a winner. You know, like, we're seeing so much, Christopher Luxon sold his houses, he's got money from me, the Brightline test. It's like, there's $30 billion of liabilities sitting there, people.
Yeah, exactly.
We're going to give it to China and Russia via one of the most corrupt financial markets that there's ever been, where 65 to 90% of transactions are fraudulent. You know, get your head in the game.
Mm-hmm.
This one, that money own the media. That's why you think what you do.
Okay, this one's strictly for you, Marty. Too good to be true with the Trump dream team. It's the ultimate spiritual counterintelligence operation. I always thought Trump seemed like the better option, but knew since 2015 that something could emerge out of his admin that would make him king of the new false Israel and world. I've been listening to both of you for about a year now. Great show, thanks. And that's DC Allen from Gisman. Thank you. Another gizzy person. Hey, Marie, the whole Democratic campaign relied on Americans being stupid and falling for the fake fluff. Talk about projection. I'm not sure they even realise what happened, which also speaks volumes. So excited for the significant marker in time. I don't worship Trump, but I appreciate his intellect and business acumen and look forward to the flow-on effects for a planetary shift. I think this is much, much bigger for humanity that many realise globally. Love your work, Amanda. And Amanda, I fully agree. We've been talking about that a lot again today. Afternoon, my favourite team from Gisborne. On the relief Trump team, what a team it is. Now to drain the swamp and watch the deep lurking creatures get exposed. Love Media Matters from Paul. Oh, thanks, Paul. We totally appreciate it. And thank you again for everyone that has shared your comments and your thoughts. 2057 is the text. Inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email. And yeah, there's so much there so much positive stuff to look at. And we just need to keep holding the course, don't we, Marty?
Yeah. We're like those people in the walking races. Just kind of
keep waddling along.
And don't worry about the chafing.
Yeah, and I see you've got Glenn Inwood and Judge Harvey back for the state. Yeah. You gave me, honestly, the laugh. I haven't laughed so hard at Fourth Estate last week. Rachel and David and you, the chemistry between the three of you was magic last week. If you've not listened to it, you must. It was wonderful. And I was walking the dog when I did it. And I think anyone driving past seeing me listening to Fourth Estate last week would have thought I was demented.
I'm always hesitant to talk about my favourite combinations because, we've got a few and they're all really great in her own way. I really enjoy it. And yeah, hopefully, you know, we can keep building on there as well as Media Doesn't Matter.
Yeah. And big week, of course, because there's lots of things moving and shaking within media as well. So the Fourth Estate to live tomorrow, so make sure you catch that. We will do this all again next week, as we do. Thank you very much, Marty. I appreciate your time again this week. And thank you again, everybody who came and joined us at the Foundation Members Club call on Sunday night and for supporting us, because without you, there wouldn't be an us. So thank you very much.
I always try to remember to thank the foundation members. It's what makes it happen. And yeah, I'd say to all of you, just keep up the sharing, you know. And, and we're trying to get, I think, cards printed so people, you can, if you're talking to someone and say, oh, I was hearing something on Reality Check Radio, and if they get that blank look and say, what? You can give them a card. But, you know, write it down.
Yeah, absolutely.
Send them a link. Share the material. I think sometimes if you share it on Facebook, I don't know whether it gets caught by the algorithm, but directly sending articles to people that you think can handle it, because it's amazing how many people would really benefit from it and probably be receptive to it who haven't heard of what we're doing. At this stage, it's still, a media source for the notices. We've got to get some of the dumbfounded dipshits in the fold as well.
Excellent. And on that note, we'll wrap it up for another week, and we'll catch you again next week. 2057 is the text. inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email. Thanks, Marty.
Thanks so much, Marie. Have a great week, everyone.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.